From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
We'd love moments where someone could see us and consider us anew. And that's what I wanted. That's what I was working towards. And now it's not just me screaming to the mountaintops, hey, reconsider us. Now it's self-evident.
Sean Levy made film studios very happy directing big family-friendly comedies, including all three Night at the Museum movies. But to make Sean Levy happy, he realized he was going to have to try something new. Now he's coming off a banner year as a producer, including a Best Picture nomination for Arrival and last summer's breakout Netflix hit, Stranger Things. Levy tells us how he set about reinventing himself and how his early experience as a cheesy actor helped him as a director. But first on the news banter, do people want their mummy? Stay tuned. It's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my associate in banter, Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So, The Mummy. The Mummy is rolling into theaters as we're taping, more or less, and this is Universal's attempt to launch what is called the Dark Universe. No, it's not about the federal bureaucracy or what is going on with Trump allies in Russia. The Dark Universe is the Monsterverse. This is clearly the thing. Disney has been feasting on Marvel. Warner has been having its problems getting the DC Universe into shape. But finally, with Wonder Woman, they've really seemed to have hit one unalloyed success that is going to really sail, it looks like. And it looks like it will crush The Mummy this weekend.
Yeah, and it's another example of whether studios are putting the cart before the horse and saying this is a franchise that demands five interconnected shared universe stories, and the audience not necessarily saying they agree with that. And Universal's not alone. I mean, Paramount is trying to do the same thing with the Transformers franchise, where this next Transformers movie, the fifth one, is going to set up a shared universe of films that will come in the future, starting with a Bumblebee spinoff starring Hailee Steinfeld. So the studios are not content to just have sequels anymore. They need these shared universe movies because it potentially creates 15 sequels. If you look at the Marvel universe, this most recent one, Guardians of the Galaxy, could be considered Iron Man 15. But it's not Iron Man 15. They've expanded it into a universe of movies that provides one to two $700 to billion grocers per year. That is a studio's dream.
Yeah, it's a dream. And what happens with this thing, it's kind of funny. They really seem to be playing more toward the international audience with Tom Cruise and Russell Crowe cast in this thing. And overall, you know, the next one that's dated, there's only one more that really is dated. That's Bride of Frankenstein. That's supposed to be directed by Bill Condon, who just had a huge success with Beauty and the Beast. And who knows, Bride of Frankenstein could work. They supposedly are chasing Angelina Jolie for that. But all of these are stars that, you know, have global appeal. And, you know, they need to find an equivalent, I think, and they're hoping to find, to a Robert Downey Iron Man character who can kind of connect the pieces. And as you see Marvel now planning to launch a new Spider-Man with a young, less known actor in Tom Holland, Robert Downey is still going to be in there, you know, serving this incredibly important purpose of being the glue.
Right. And that's Sony essentially admitting after the last two Spider-Man movies kind of fizzled, saying, we need Marvel to do this for us. So they made a partnership with Disney, essentially very interesting and kind of unprecedented partnership, to bring in Marvel Studios to help them relaunch the Spider-Man franchise. And what did they do? They're throwing their A-list person at Spider-Man and putting Robert Downey Jr. in a major role in the Spider-Man Homecoming movie, which comes out in a few weeks. And that is an example of how a shared universe can work. The goodwill of one movie spills into the introduction of a new movie. And then that essentially creates a domino effect that 6 years later, you end up with Guardians of the Galaxy. And I think every studio wants that. So you're seeing that with Universal right now with The Mummy. And if it does well overseas, you know, not necessarily at home, maybe there will be enough goodwill where it will spill into these other movies where characters can pop in, they can pop out, and it creates a franchise beyond just sequels.
Meanwhile, we'll see whether the Dark Universe becomes a universe. The Dark Overlord is a lot more sinister. The Dark Overlord is a hacking collective. They claim to have gotten a bunch of property, weirdly, including 8 unaired episodes of a Steve Harvey show on ABC called Thunderdome, which, you know, I mean, if you're going to steal stuff. Come on, guys. But
I think ABC's happy for the publicity.
Yeah, they're like, oh, good, now it's more famous. But the Dark Overlord is, you know, it seems that they are doing some hacking. Supposedly Netflix has been a victim, and Disney, it appeared, people speculated that they seemed to have gotten Pirates of the Caribbean, except there's no evidence that they really did. But there are people who feel that ransom is being paid for things that we're just not hearing about.
Yeah, and that's interesting. We had actually at Hollywood Reporter, we had an interview, if you can call it, with the Dark Overlord. We exchanged some messages with this person who said, I'm quoting him, if it is a him, I'm quoting the Dark Overlord, Hollywood is under attack. And I think that is a sentiment that should be somewhat alarming to the industry, because if this is a concerted effort by one or many people to essentially take content, it is stealing, and put it out there online. We make fun of the Steve Harvey Show, but if a real Hollywood blockbuster gets put online and is shared everywhere, that can be very damaging to a film. We saw that with one of the Expendables sequels a few years ago, where maybe it wouldn't have done as much as the previous film anyways, but a lot of people associated with that Expendables film really thought that the leak of that film really hurt it. And if this is going to be a thing that the industry is going to have to deal with over and over again, there's potential damages here.
They have apparently taken stuff that is much more valuable than Thunderdome would appear to be, like NCIS Los Angeles and things that are major network shows. So, you know, piracy has been a major priority for Hollywood for a really long time. And in this era now, it becomes very difficult. We see the power of what can be done by hackers, and the studios are feeling it. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, editorial director of The Hollywood Reporter. If you know all about 11, the upside down, and the use of Christmas lights as a means of communication, that music also will be very familiar to you. Last July, Stranger Things on Netflix came seemingly out of nowhere to become the buzziest show of the summer. The executive producer of Stranger Things is Sean Levy, who before last year was best known as a director of family-friendly comedies, notably Night at the Museum, in which Ben Stiller played a guard who discovered that when the tourists went home, the exhibits came alive. That included a giant statue from Easter Island, voiced by Brad Garrett.
Oh, you in trouble, dum-dum. You better run, run from Attila the Hun-Hun.
That's broad comedy, and it had broad appeal. The three Night at the Museum movies, all directed by Levy, made more than $1 billion worldwide. But eventually, Levy wanted to break out of his box. He began to expand the mission of his production company, 21 Laps. And last year, his efforts paid off in a big way. In addition to Stranger Things, he produced Arrival, nominated for 8 Oscars, including Best Picture and Best Director. Levy has come a long way from where he began his career, not behind the camera, but in front of it. I got to start out. Zombie Nightmare.
Oh, wow. I'm A, impressed, B, horrified.
I did not know you were an actor.
You're stretching and being really generous with that term, but yes.
What year?
Like Zombie Nightmare, if you want us to start there and place that, I feel like that might be 1987 or 8. So I'm from Montreal, and I used to do some acting when I was a kid, and then I went to Yale as an undergrad, and I would go back to Montreal during the summers, and my summer job was acting in movies and TV shows that were filming in Quebec and Montreal due to what were at that time amazing, I think, tax incentives. And so I got this leading role in this horror movie called Zombie Nightmare. And I played this long-haired bad boy. And I do meet a karmically right end when the zombie, he impales me on a softball bat.
Okay.
And that was really fun. And then when I moved out to LA, I spent the first year or so acting to pay for graduate school. One of those gigs was in Beverly Hills 90210. And my vivid memory of that is we had these scenes protesting City Hall because like Tori Spelling's character had been expelled for drinking. And we would protest, Donna Martin graduates. And Luke Perry, who was a god in my eyes at that time, scandalized me because he was screaming, Donna Martin masturbates, Donna Martin. And I'm like, wait, you can't say that. That's not the line. But it was like the height of rebellion and cool to me at that time. But I'll tell you, I would not trade the acting background for anything, not only because it gives me fun anecdotes to tell you here, but that's always been the part of the job that I've been the most comfortable with.
I'm sure there's nothing like that experience for a director.
After Yale, I went to USC for graduate film school, and it was interesting to me that they spend, and this is true of most film schools, the bulk of your time is spent learning cinematography, editing, lighting. But in fact, a director has help with all of those jobs. The only part of the director's craft that you do not get help with is the interfacing and direction of your actors. And so I was thrilled that my acting background, even though it included less glamorous moments like impalement on a softball bat by a zombie.
Small price.
And set me up certainly for this job in some ways.
I mean, I'll just say we had lunch probably several months ago.
Yeah.
And we talked about how well-known you had become for the Night at the Museum movies and how you then deliberately set about changing things for yourself.
Yeah, well, I do think it's something that all of us in any industry, we understand that feeling of not wanting to be ungrateful for the successes that one has had, but this kind of itch to be more than what we've been. And to, frankly, get the opportunity to do more than what we've done. And so for me, the kind of family comedy genre, it came very naturally to me. But I always knew that my taste as an audience member is in a far broader swath of tone. And I was really determined to tell stories in that broader range. And I didn't know, I still don't know, frankly, whether or not I'll get to tell stories in that broader range as a director, but I knew that I wanted to use 21 Laps, which is my production company that I started now almost 12 years ago. I wanted to use my production company to nurture and ultimately tell stories in that broader range. And I've devoted myself, especially in the last, I guess now almost 2.5 years since I made and released the last Night at the Museum film, I've devoted myself to broadening that identity as a storyteller. And a lot of it's worked out. Particularly last year was a year to dream about and a year to remember, and hopefully not the last great year, but really where all of the time and love and energy that I was putting into my production company with and alongside my colleagues there, that it kind of bore fruit in really exciting ways.
It certainly did. So say you're you and you know that you have this desire. What's the first move?
Well, I guess the first move was to parlay that clout that box office success gave me into the founding of a company. And so really the first move was to express that ambition to my partners who at that time and still today are at 20th Century Fox. And they very generously gave me what's called an overall deal.
I'm sure it was a very good deal, but self-interest always rules in these.
Well, I'm sure what they saw in the year, I mean, yes, no, they were not financing Sean Levy's desire to grow creatively.
Right. They're thinking, we'll get another Night at the Museum out of this.
We want the Night at the Museum guy to give us more Night at the Museums or movies like that.
Right.
But we did have a kind of a beneficial intersection of self-interest, I guess you could say. Maybe that's all business in Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, the first move was, A, to articulate to the creative community, you know me as this person. There's more to that person. And so I want to meet writers, actors, fellow filmmakers with different visions, with different voices. And frankly, for the first several years, it didn't kind of show or net that many results. But we devote ourselves to two things. One is, if anyone has a juicy idea, let's throw all of our energies and labor at it to make it into a movie. So like when I came up with the idea for Date Night, at Date Night with my wife, I had a place where I could go literally the next morning and say to my 5 employees, hey guys, it's called Date Night. It's about marriage. It's about the ruts that marriage can find and the way that that might get shaken up. And I was able to develop that into a movie for myself. But this was a key moment. One of the assistants at 21 Laps brought up one week, they said, you know, there's this book that I came across and it was called The Spectacular Now. And we spent years trying to find anyone who was interested in giving us the money to make that small R-rated high school drama and ultimately got Spectacular Now made. And I've always said that it was, I think, the lowest budget movie I've ever been involved in. It probably made less cumulatively than A Night at the Museum made in its first hour on its Friday opening day. But the value of that movie to me and 21 Laps has been just massive, because when people come into 21 Laps and they see the posters of the things we've been involved in, that's a disruptor. And that slowly led to the moment that we're now in today.
You get reevaluated.
Yeah. And I think that's what we all want, right? We'd all, in our relationships, in our careers, we'd love moments where someone could see us and consider us anew. And that's what I wanted. That's what I was working towards. And now it's not just me screaming to the mountaintops,
I should say not.
Reconsider us. Mm-hmm. Now the kind of, it's self-evident. And that's been really gratifying.
You have this, I don't even know how many projects in development, some insane number, 50-something, I think.
That seems, well, for one thing, I bet if we went through them, but no one wants us to do that.
Right, we won't do that.
Many of them have gone fallow, I'm sure.
Right.
Some of them are probably inaccurate. But yes, we do, I would say we have maybe 30-some-odd projects in active development.
And I see that they are everything, like every kind of thing. So when you say your tastes were beyond the comedy that you did with Night at the Museum, it seems what you're really saying is, I like everything.
I think the only thing that I don't respond to would be really hardcore horror, or frankly, something that is relentlessly cynical. I don't believe in that mindset, and I don't want to work on something with that kind of nihilistic content. I am something of an idealist. I certainly try and live that way. And so I like working on things that have some kind of humanism. But you are right. You'll see Sesame Street, and you'll see, you know, you'll see a Bill Graham biopic, and you'll see a YA, you know, redemption tale. It does run the gamut, but that's because if I listed my top 10 favorite movies to you, they'd be similarly eclectic, and they would make no sense other than probably a unifying theme of hope and ultimately the possibility of redemption for its characters.
Coming up after a short break, director and producer Sean Levy tells us why he said a quick yes to Stranger Things and how his plans to return to directing may involve a very popular video game that I'd never heard of. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? Critics rave The Greatest Hits is a music-infused romance that hits all the right notes and the most original time travel story in years. Featuring music by Nelly Furtado, Beach House, Jamie XX, and more. Watch The Greatest Hits, now streaming on Hulu.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
And I'm Kim Masters. We're talking to filmmaker Sean Levy. Previously known as a director of broad comedies, Levy has expanded into producing all kinds of projects in all sorts of genres, including the Oscar-nominated film Arrival. Levy's company, 21 Laps, also had the TV hit of last summer, Stranger Things, on Netflix. In the sci-fi horror mystery series, Winona Ryder plays a 1980s Midwest mom who's been pushed to the brink by her child's disappearance and who believes she can communicate with him through blinking Christmas lights.
Okay, baby, talk to me. Talk to me. Where are you? R. Good, 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 good. That's good. Come on, come on. I. G. H. T. H-E-R-E, right here, right here. I don't know what that means. I need you to tell me what to do. What should I do? How do I get to you?
Season 2 of Stranger Things returns to Netflix later this year, on Halloween, in fact. While everything seemed to fall into place for Levy last year, he says it was to some degree coincidence that a couple of big projects came to fruition around the same time.
Arrival started now almost 6 years ago, in a general meeting between a guy, Eric Heiserer, who was known as a horror film writer at that point, he had with the two executives that I affectionately call the Dans. It's Dan Levine, who's the president of 21 Laps, and Dan Cohen, who's the VP. And they took a general meeting with the screenwriter. And as the meeting was ending, they asked him what he was reading and responding to. And he mentioned this collection of short stories by Ted Chiang. And from that collection, we found Story of Your Life, which is the short story that became Arrival. But that's a five-year journey. And the bottom line is, we liked Eric's writing. We liked him personally. And we wanted to see if we could cook something up. And now I could give you 10 stories like that. Because I'm a so-called perceived comedy director who is asking the world to reconsider that assumption, 21 Laps starts from a place of, we're not going to lock someone into some perceived box. I don't want it done to me. I'm not going to do it to fellow storytellers. And that is the culture at 21 Laps. And so,
God, there's going to be a deluge of submissions like 5 minutes after this is put up.
I may live to regret these words, but similarly, Stranger Things was a spec pilot that Dan Cohen found that some people had seen, but no one had seized on it. These were two 32-year-old brothers, the Duffer brothers, Ross and Matt, who had made a single feature film that they wrote and directed that had been shelved at Warner Brothers, who had briefly been on the staff of Wayward Pines, but they were, in the parlance of Hollywood, they weren't names. They weren't even semi-names. They were kind of young nobodies at that point. But Dan Cohen walked into my office one day and said, stop, read. And I read this pilot, and it was immediate. And I brought the Duffers in, and I said, guys, I know why on paper there might be more, and I'm making air quote here, right, appropriate producers for Stranger Things who live in this genre space more full time. But I get this. I get you. And most importantly, I want to put this on my back alongside you and bring it into the world. And that's exactly what happened.
It sounds like a movie.
The kind of the crazy Hollywood ending to that movie is what happened by July 16th, within 12 hours of our streaming debut on July 15th, we knew that it was not like anything we had seen, but we had no idea if anyone would watch it. Truly, we had no idea. We would watch other Netflix shows get released with far more fanfare and marketing budget and, you know, the volume turned up to high. We now are quite proud of the fact that Stranger Things was put into the world and the show did its work for us all. And most importantly, the fans of the show did the work for the show. And it became this kind of, like, I've heard it referred to as a viral blockbuster. And it's a little bit how it's felt to us.
I don't know the actual history of how many places you tried to put it or whether you went straight to Netflix or what you did with it.
The brothers, it had been exposed to some studios. They hadn't really done the rounds at buyers at network, and they got a lot of passes. And I think for two reasons. One was the kind of the perceived audacity of these two unknown young brothers saying, we're going to create it, we're going to run it, and also we want to direct a bunch of them. So I know that that was not initially well received, but there was also pre-Stranger Things, the conventional wisdom in the film and television industry is you can't make something starring kids that isn't for kids. And Stranger Things was always built around this cadre of kids, but this show was never designed as a kid show. It flouted conventional wisdom. But I will tell you, the first network that I went into with the Duffers was Netflix, and they bought the entire season by the next morning. So we never pitched a second network together.
And that was because?
With the brothers, it was always an eight-hour movie in their minds. And I knew that a conventional network, 7 days between episodes kind of model, wouldn't do justice to what they saw as one long piece of storytelling.
Bingeable.
Bingeable.
Because there are those who say don't binge, but you say binge.
But Stranger Things was built that way. And the brothers, their sense of rhythm and pacing and the way we parcel out information and reveals and emotional satisfactions, we do so with the possibility that people could ingest it in one very exhausting, long seating.
Yeah, I had to devise a strategy for to get away from it. I had to say, I'm going to be right in the middle, and when this scene ends, I'm going to bed. Because yeah. Otherwise, I'm going to be sitting
and, here. And I've heard a lot of confessions along those lines, and the kind of the unique experience of Stranger Things is that unlike a conventional television series, there's no studio. So the creative team is abnormally small. And as a result, the creative control has remained really, really undiluted. And when we've had moments of satisfaction, winning awards or that get good reviews, and the numbers appear to be pretty huge around the world, we take an authentic pride in that because everybody did the work.
So what do you want to do? I saw you attached to this game.
I love it, by the way. The Uncharted fanatics, let it be known that Kim Masters refers to it as this
game.
... game.
Yes, I do not know.
Uncharted is this wildly successful and award-winning Sony PlayStation video game that's gone through 4 iterations.
And I will just say that Sony would very much love to have PlayStation properties like that made into entertainment.
Yes. I mean,
and
Uncharted,
vice versa, entertainment
made Uncharted
into games.
Is definitely in the era of IP and corporate mandates. I think it's no secret that Uncharted is one of those titles at Sony that is a corporate mandate. They really, really want to see that movie get made. And it's been in development for, I think, like 7 or 8 years, many different scripts, few different directors. I got involved in it at the end of last year because I see in it this opportunity to do a contemporary rogue treasure hunter movie. And a few months ago, Tom Rothman approached me with this notion.
The chairman of the film studio.
Forgive me, chairman of Sony. And he said, look, we keep trying to develop versions of the movie that are exactly like the game. What if we don't play that game? What if we actually tell the story of the origins of these characters? And Tom had at that point seen Spider-Man Homecoming, which is the new Spidey, with this young actor, Tom Holland, plays Peter Parker, was magnificent in the Bayona film The Impossible and several other films. And in chatting with him, he's a huge fan of the game. And part of his whole point of view was, stop giving us video games that are like what we can get for free at home.
Right.
And that really resonated. And so now in working with Tom Holland and in talking with new screenwriter candidates for that job, that is a movie I very much hope to make. And if we make one movie well, maybe we get a chance to make others.
Is that your next directing job?
You know what? It's unclear, Kim. I would love it to be Uncharted. The other one that feels very near horizon is a Amblin movie. That's the name of Steven Spielberg's company, DreamWorks.
Right.
But it's basically a couple going through a divorce in the midst of an alien invasion. It's this really fascinating screenplay that they sent me. And, you know, it needs further refinement, and I'm working on that too. But that's another opportunity. What I like is that neither Uncharted nor The Fall, which is the name of that Amblin project, feel like something I've done, that they're both opportunities to continue to stretch in those cases directorially.
So with Fox in the background going, but Night at the Museum.
Night at the Museum, I wouldn't say that that is done and gone forever. I'm sure that I will live to see the day where some new hotshot director is going to reboot or re-envision my franchise. But for now, and quite honestly, not to get too heavy, but when Robin Williams passed away as I was editing the last film, it did a lot of things to me, to my head, to my heart. And it is one reason why you'll note that with every month since that last film, I have willfully devoted myself to growth and to change and to difference. And there was something about making that film with that cast and then Robin passing. And it felt like that really is a goodbye for me. And it feels okay. And it feels right that that's a farewell for me.
Sean Levy, producer, director, founder of 21 Laps Entertainment. Thank you for coming in.
Thanks for having me. That was fun.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. You can subscribe to The Business as well as other great KCRW podcasts at kcrw.com/podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.